This is The Full Spectrum. The show provides a wide range of news and competing opinions. The commentaries, beliefs, and viewpoints expressed by segment hosts and guests do not necessarily represent those of WJSU-FM, Jackson State University, or its administrators. The content of this program is for informational and/or entertainment value only and not meant as an endorsement or recommendation in lieu of professional guidance on relevant topics.
It's the full spectrum. We got news.
Entertainment.
Interviews. And so much more. It's the full spectrum.
On today's show, an in-depth conversation with the former U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of South Africa, Delano Lewis. Welcome to The Full Spectrum for Wednesday, July 11th. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. The former U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of South Africa, Delano Lewis, has written a new book about his life called No Condition is Permanent, A Collection of Memories. Ambassador Lewis was born in Arkansas City, Kansas, in 1938, and as you're about to hear, he's traveled a very long way in his life. I spoke with Ambassador Lewis earlier today about his life and his new book. Okay, Mr. Ambassador, the name of the book is No Condition is Permanent, A Collection of Memories, and if I'm not mistaken, that main title, No Condition is Permanent, is an African proverb. How did you choose that main title?
Yes, it is an African proverb, West African. As you'll find out in the book, I served as a staff person in the U.S. Peace Corps in Nigeria and in Uganda. And in Nigeria, they would have on the trucks that they call lorries, they would have signs and proverbs on the trucks. And the one proverb that stuck with me over time was, no condition is permanent. And it really just called to mind over the years that when you're high and things are going well, keep in mind that it will change. And when things are not going so well and you may be a little low, it may also change for the better. So the question is, are you ready for change? So I thought it was quite emblematic of my career, and I thought it was an African proverb to live by.
And it's a self-described collection of memories that takes the reader into your life. And I'm always interested when people write these kind of collections, how they came to choose the set of memories they chose. So was it difficult for you, because you've had a very full life, to narrow it down to which of those memories you wanted to portray your life?
Well, that's a very good question. And I must say that I wrote the book with my third son, Brian Lewis. Gail and I have four sons, and Brian is number three son, who is a trained chef, but he is also a writer and executive coach himself. And he basically wanted to lay the foundation for the book, and he's been thinking about it for a long time. And he started thinking about growing up in this family, our dinner table conversations, all the things that we did in my careers and things we did for fun and so on. So he had in his mind some of the things that he thought would be important for me to share. So I must give a lot of that to Brian. And so he started putting down those thoughts. I've done a lot of speeches and a lot of articles and all those kinds of things. I've written one other book. So Brian has been involved. My sons have been involved as well as my wife. So Brian helped put that foundation together and begin to think about the various stories that he thought I should share. And then my wife and I edited the book and put out the final copy. So it was a family effort.
And it's clear from the book that family is important to you. You mentioned that you first moved to Washington, D.C. in 1963, and you went to work for the Justice Department. And I wanted to go back to that for a minute, because you had a law degree. Mm-hmm. You decided to go work for the government. And I wanted to ask you, what options were available to a black man in 1963 who had a law degree? Could you have gone into private practice? Why did you decide to go to work for the Justice Department?
Yeah, that's talked about a little bit in the book, and it's a very good question. The options were very limited. There were not that many firms that were hiring black lawyers, particularly integrated or white firms that were hiring black lawyers. I could go into law practice, which I did, with a very prominent black attorney in Topeka, Kansas, and he was a trial lawyer, P.A. Townsend, and I thought I could learn from Prentice Townsend about the law and the courtroom. But I was married and had two kids when I graduated from law school. So I was very concerned about how I'm going to support a family. And as it would have it, luck would have it, my next-door neighbor worked for the U.S. Attorney for the state of Kansas. And it was through her that I got interviewed with the U.S. Attorney. And the U.S. Attorney, Newell George, was a Kennedy friend. And he put my name in for the Honors Program for the Department of Justice when Bobby Kennedy was the AG and John Kennedy was the president. And he was a very close Kennedy friend. In fact, he lost his bid for Congress in the early 60s. So JFK, when he became president, made him U.S. attorney. So he sent a letter to Bobby Kennedy and told him that I would have been an honor student if I hadn't had to work and support a family. I worked 40 hours a week and went to law school full time. He said, this young man would have been an honors student, and I'd like to recommend him for the honors program for the Department of Justice. And several months went by, and I heard from the Justice Department, and I was accepted to the honors program and went to work in Washington in November 1963. It was a combination of things that got me there, but my options were limited.
It's interesting. You were there 3 years and you decided to act on an opportunity in 1966 to go to the Peace Corps. What was going through your mind at that time? Because that's a term there, and it seems significant in terms of what you ended up doing over the course of your life.
Yes, it was a very, very intricate turning point in my life. I'd worked at Justice for 2 years, and I really wanted to move out of Justice. I was not in civil rights. I was in internal security, and the work just was not to my liking. It was a good job, so I ended up when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was established. One of my good friends from Washburn Law School, Sam Jackson, who was appointed by Lyndon Johnson as one of the EEOC commissioners, and it was through Sam that I got a chance to come to EEOC, and that was a great opportunity because I was doing civil rights and something I wanted to do. But lo and behold, at a dinner party by a former Justice Department colleague, there was a woman there who was a Peace Corps desk officer and asked me if I was interested in Peace Corps staff. And I had no idea such an opportunity would exist, that I could go with my family. I had three kids at that time. I would be on a federal salary. My housing would be provided. It was an unbelievable opportunity, but it was a big leap for me because I wanted to stay in the country and work and continue to work in civil rights. This would take me away from the law, take me out of the country. My wife was very, very excited about it. She was very adventuresome. She really didn't feel there was a choice. She said, let's do this. And let me tell you, she was right. It expanded our horizons. We had a fourth child born in Uganda. I became country director. I managed 160 volunteers when I was 28 years of age. It opened up the world to me. And so it was a leap of faith, but again, it certainly was out of my comfort zone.
I want to talk about how it shaped your philosophy as well. I know it opened up a lot of opportunities for you, but in terms of your relationship with public servitude and the things you would do in your life, how did that particular 3 years working in the Peace Corps shape you?
Well, first of all, it was a great administrative opportunity. I was an assistant director in Nigeria. And then a year later, we had to leave because of the civil war in Nigeria, and I was appointed country director. So in other words, I was in charge of the Peace Corps and the 160-plus volunteers. So it was a great administrative job, in other words, running an office. The second piece of it was in another part of the world. It was in a different culture. So you had to learn to deal with different languages, different cultures, different religions, different foods. You had to learn how to communicate with the ministry and the government system that was different from your own. So it just sort of opened up my horizons. It also gave me an inquisitive feel for what's beyond America, how people view us in America, how other systems work. So it was a great opening up of my horizons. And then coming back to America, I was in a little bit of a quandary because how do I make use of those kinds of opportunities? And I worked at the Peace Corps desk for a while in charge of Eastern Southern Africa, and then I went to work on Capitol Hill. But that global experience always put me in good stead because I understood other cultures, and that certainly came into play when I became president of NPR and when I became an ambassador. It did shape my horizons.
You say you worked on Capitol Hill. You worked as a legislative assistant for Republican Senator Edward Brooke. You know, today our philosophy is very shaped by the two parties. What was it like going to work? And Edward Brooke was black, but he was a Republican. Were the party delineations as marked then as they are now?
Yes, there were certainly differences in the two parties. But I don't think it was as partisan in those days as it is today. And also, as things have changed, many Democrats in the South, for example, have become Republicans. Back in the Brooke era, he was the only black senator at that time in the U.S. Senate since Reconstruction. And at that time, there were liberal Republicans. There was Mark Hatfield from Oregon, Jacob Javits of New York. They were liberal Republicans along with Edward Brooke, and you don't seem to have many liberal Republicans today. There are very few moderate Republicans. So that has changed. The partisan nature of things have become much more in focus than it was at that time. But working for Senator Brooke and tell you about his life, he became Attorney General of Massachusetts, and then he ran for statewide office and was elected. But he ran as a Democrat twice, I think, for a congressional seat, and he lost. So he decided to run as a Republican, and he won. Now, I think he sort of dealt with the Republicans on fiscal issues. In other words, he was fairly moderate to conservative on fiscal issues, but on social issues, he was very, very liberal. And he was also very liberal in foreign relations. And so he really struck his difference. He became a party person, but he struck his own difference because he moved out on the Foreign Relations Committee and he moved out in social legislation. And I must tell you, with the Supreme Court nomination coming up soon, he defeated two Supreme Court nominees, Carswell and Haynesworth, if you remember those names, who were put forth, and they were very conservative, and Senator Brooke led the charge to defeat their nominations.
Wow.
So anyway, I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, more of my interview with Ambassador Delano Lewis. Stick around.
Support of this program is made in part by Griffith Financial Services, helping Jacksonians with their retirement and life plans, as well as critical, chronic, and terminal illness protection. Griffith Financial Services is available at 800-361-6542 or griffithfinancialservices.com. For a consultation today, the More tab is at your fingertips.
Welcome back to The Full Spectrum on Cool and Current WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. We return now to my interview with the former ambassador to the Republic of South Africa, Delano Lewis, who says he once thought about being a politician himself. You actually ran for public office yourself, I believe, against Marion Barry. I think you were running for the city council in Washington, D.C.
That is correct.
And so talk to me about that experience. I know you lost that race. Do you think if you had won that race, you would have walked that path and stayed in politics?
Yeah, that's an interesting question as well. I've been with the telephone company only a year. They had great hopes for me. They didn't believe that I was going to, if I got elected, leave a very important job. I was a public affairs manager and had a future there. But anyway, I got excited about politics. Home rule had come to the city, and there were four at-large seats, but only two seats could be held by the majority party, and that was the Democratic Party at the time and still is. And the other two seats were for the minority party, independent statehood or Republican. So there were nine of us running in the at-large seat in the Democratic primary. So I wasn't running against Marion particularly. I figured he had a lot of name recognition at that time, that he probably could get one seat for sure. But I thought with my energy and with my campaign organization and money I raised that I could get that second seat. But what I didn't understand at the time that I knew it didn't have good name recognition, but I think that was the key. So I fought for the second seat with Reverend Douglas Moore, who was a civil rights activist, who had more name recognition than I did. I lost that seat by just several thousand votes in the Democratic primary. So I came in third. And your question about what if?
right.
many people feel that if I would have run again for city council, I would be elected. Many thought, as Don Graham did, who wrote the foreword to my book, he really thought I should run for mayor, and then he thought I might be elected mayor. So there were many people thought that I had a career in politics in D.C. My wife had other thoughts. She felt that that was not the kind of career that was compatible with family, and she counseled against it, and I listened to her, and I didn't run again. And shortly thereafter, I got promoted to the telephone company to an assistant vice president. And then I had a long and, I think, successful career of 21 years in telephone company.
That was a very exciting time to be working for Bell Atlantic. They had split up AT&T. They had made these so-called baby bells. There was a lot going on there. We know that the phone companies were fighting to be able to do more things. Talk to me about what was going on when you were there.
This was a very, very exciting time. I was very, very fortunate to have worked in that system for 21 years. And, you know, it was about even 10 years before the breakup and 10 or 11 years after the breakup. So I was with one of the largest companies in the old AT&T system, Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company. And it was a four-state company, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and the District of Columbia. And I had good mentors and good advisors and people who really supported me. And I was, when I was brought in, I came in fairly high, and I was the highest ranking African-American when I came in 1971. And I had mentors along the way that really helped me navigate. And when the system was broken up, the advice was by my mentor to stay with the Baby Bells and not go with AT&T. And that was good advice. So I stayed with Bell Atlantic, and I had a chance because I worked very closely with the vice president there. So when he retired, I was in the running to replace him. So I became vice president and then ultimately president of the operations in the District of Columbia of Bell Atlantic. And that was made up of Pennsylvania Bell, New Jersey Bell, Diamond State in Delaware, and the four CNPs, seven companies in the Bell Atlantic. So matter of fact, I always felt it was one of the strongest of the Baby Bells, along with Southwestern Bell. And then as things played out, it ended up seven Baby Bells finally became three Baby Bells, and Bell Atlantic was still one of those that was very forceful and merged with 9X, which was New York and New England, and became Verizon.
Which we know is one of the big players now.
That's right. So I was very fortunate to be where I was positioned. And I was also worked very hard and had good mentors, and I was able to navigate it from CNP to Bell Atlantic to Verizon. A very exciting time.
And you also served as the president and CEO of NPR. I want to ask you what that experience is like, but I also want you to juxtapose your experience in the private sector to that in the government sector. If you had to choose, which was more fulfilling to you?
Well, it's a very hard question to answer. Let me come at it this way, that again, I was very fortunate to be in the old Bell system with Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company, because the Bell system at that time, you know, really encouraged their executives to give back to the community, encouraged their executives to work in the community. They believed that customers were important and that the telephone executives were part of their community. And so when I went into the business world, it was a regulated business, and so that helped me sort of transition in the business world. The other piece of it was a company that pushed and encouraged community participation. So I came into a company, into public affairs, and shortly thereafter, they gave public relations to me, and I was in charge of all the community relations, all the community contributions, budgets, and so on, was under my jurisdiction. So I had a chance, I had both worlds at that time, being able to serve in the community and to learn business. It was just a very fortunate coincidence for me.
I really want to ask you, as a former leader there at NPR, how do you feel now about their role? There's, you know, always talk about, do we need to have a public broadcasting system?
Being at NPR was an exciting challenge. And in the book, I talk about my first 100 days, and the Gingrich Congress at that time in 1994 was getting ready to, had a contract to with America, as they called it, and they were going to zero out public broadcasting, which included PBS and NPR. So right at that time, and it still happens today, that there are some politicians that want to take out some of the federal subsidy. But NPR is still remains to this day a very unique and very reputable broadcasting, public broadcasting effort. It still does, I think, very good in-depth news. It covers international news probably better than any other media company at this time. And it does in-depth analysis, and I think you can get very balanced news from NPR. So it's still very valued. Now, when my time was there in 94 to 98, there was resistance to embrace new technologies. And so if there's one thing I felt I might have accomplished was begin to get NPR to think about the use of the Internet and to think about how we related as a communications company with technology. But I still think it's quite valuable and still needs to be preserved as a very reputable media company.
I don't know how you perceive it. I wouldn't be shocked if you saw it as the crowning jewel of your career. You served as ambassador to the Republic of South Africa. Tell me how that came about.
Yes, it was probably the pinnacle of the things that I had accomplished over my life. And I was just quite honored to be nominated and confirmed as the United States Ambassador to the Republic of South Africa. It came about as a surprise to me, I must tell you. I didn't know that I was being considered. I'd had Africa experience with the Peace Corps. I had worked on the board of AFRICARE, an NGO in the U.S. that does projects around the continent of Africa. I had a strong interest, but I did not know that I was being considered. And one day, as we were moving from one house to another here in Las Cruces, New Mexico, the phone rings, and my wife answers, and she says, "Yes, he's here." And she passed the phone to me, and as she does, she whispers to me, "Vice President." And so I picked up the phone, and it says, "Dell, this is Al." And I said, "Mr. Vice President, what do I owe this honor?" He said, his voice became very official. He said, "I'm calling on behalf of President Clinton, and the president would like to nominate you as the next United States ambassador to the Republic of South Africa." And I said, "What did you say, Mr. Vice President?" I was absolutely surprised. I turned to my wife, and I was half in tears. I said, "The president would like to nominate me as the next ambassador to South Africa." And she shook her head, "Yes." And I went back to the phone. I said, "Mr. Vice President, I accept." He said, "Congratulations. You're here from State Department." Click. That was it. And I had no idea I was being considered. And I write about that in the book. And again, it was one of those exciting places. To be a U.S. ambassador is a great honor to serve, but to serve in the Republic of South Africa that had just gone through its first democratic elections 5 years earlier, where Nelson Mandela was elected president, and he only served one term and stepped down. So when I came in 99, Thabo Mbeki was the president. I presented my credentials to Thabo Mbeki, and I talk about that in my book. And then I also made an introductory call on President Nelson Mandela. So I over that year and a half, I had a chance to visit with him on a number of occasions, and I had a chance to go all over the Republic, work with USAID on HIV and AIDS issues, work with the economics officer on business issues. It was an extraordinary experience. It's the second largest embassy at that time on the continent. So the South Africa American presence there is very, very important.
You know, you've had clearly a remarkable career, a very full life. I want to end up with a personal question. You know, in the book, you talk about your relationship with your father. You say he didn't talk a lot, and you write about how you and your mother followed him from Arkansas City to Kansas City when he got a job with the railroad. It's very poignant. You don't write a lot about it, but I wonder how your relationship with your father has shaped your relationship with your four sons. And it's very clear how important family is to you. Do you feel like in your lifetime you've come full circle in terms of family, the family you were born into and the family you have helped raise?
That's such an excellent question. Family is extremely important. I grew up as an only child in a segregated community in Kansas City, Kansas. I was born in Arkansas City, Kansas. And then, as I say in the book, my dad moved. My mother said, we're going to follow because he got this great job as a porter on the Santa Fe Railroad, and he worked for 37 years on the Santa Fe Railroad. They stayed together as a couple. They gave me everything they could. I must tell you that, yes, we were poor and modest, but I didn't want for anything. They gave me everything they could. They had stressed education. They paid for my undergrad, and I worked as well. I worked as a waiter. And then when I got married right after undergrad, my dad turned to me and he says, what are you going to live off of when you get married? I says, well, if Gail doesn't become pregnant, she's going to work. I'm going to work. He says, I said I was going to help you through law school, and I will. And one of the big things that he did was to pay for my tuition in law school, even though I was married. And I then went to work as well. So family was important. My mother and I spent a lot of time together. She was a high school graduate. My dad was 11th grade, but she read a lot. She had interests outside the home. She exposed me to music, to dance, and to the arts, and to reading. So I had a full life. And again, my dad didn't say much, but when he did, and his support was always there. So when I married, a terrific person in Gail Jones. We met in Lawrence, and we had the four sons, and we have tried to, again, raise them to be what they want to be. And, yes, I've come full circle. Family is extremely important. I knew I wanted to have more than one child, and we have four adult sons and 11 grandchildren. And we now, I am definitely blessed, for sure.
Well, Ambassador Lewis, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. And I want to thank you for your public service. The name of the book, again, is No Condition is Permanent, A Collection of Memories. And if I'm not mistaken, it's available on Amazon.
Well, it's available on Amazon on the Kindle version, but you can get the paperback by going to my website, AmbassadorDelanoLewis.com, or OrderNewBook.com. And you can get it shipped to you right away. And thank you, Mr. Doty, for a wonderful interview, and to thank Anthony Dean and Jackson State. I appreciate having this conversation. Thank you so much.
And thank you again, Ambassador Lewis. Well, that's our show for today. Don't forget to catch Metro Morning Live with Rob J. hosting. That's at 7 and 10 tomorrow morning on JSU TV. You can catch their live stream on Facebook. Just type in Jackson State TV, one word. We'll be back tomorrow at 4 with more of the Full Spectrum right here on FM 88.5, or you can catch our live stream on WJSU.org. Up next, Latin Jazz with host Dale Morris. Have a great evening.